Welcome to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for the following edition of Soundings comes from the Burroughs Wellcome Company, a research-based pharmaceutical company with corporate headquarters and laboratories in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Additional support for this edition of Soundings comes from the Eugene Garfield Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Unquestionably, there's not an art of medicine, there are the arts of medicine. First of all, there is the art of being a very good listener. There's the art of developing a sense of trust with a patient. There's the art of negotiating the incredible bureaucracy that medicine has become today. And then there's the art of trying to wend one's way through a seemingly endless amount of knowledge to try and pick and choose.
I would say, in perspective, it seems to me that we've been through a couple of decades post-World War II in which the power of technology was so glittering and so powerful, and is the right word, that it, in the eyes of many learning to be physicians, it suppressed or supplanted the significance of the effectiveness of the interhuman interactions. Our students are serious students of the humane aspects of medical practice.
Medicine and Social Ethics, the second segment in a series of conversations this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a discussion with two physicians, Philip Riley of the Shriver Center in Waltham, Massachusetts, and Stuart Bondurant, Dean of the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Among the issues Philip Riley and Stuart Bondurant will discuss are medicine and cost containment, the national debates about abortion and AIDS, and the ethical responsibilities of physicians and other caregivers to their patients. What do individual physicians talk about when a topic like cost containment comes up? Phil?
They talk of many things, but two immediately come to mind. First, the fear that cost containment strategies, however well-intentioned, will jeopardize their ability to give the best medical care possible to their patient. And secondly, that the cost containment strategies really have not yet proven themselves as, in fact, accomplishing the goal that they are set out to do.
Uh-huh.
We've now lived through, maybe 5 to 10 years of discussion about this, certainly five, and I don't know of any real strong proof that cost containment strategies absolutely accomplish the goal that they're intending to accomplish.
One of the conventions of the conversation, the national dialogue, is that doctors are powerful, that they are the people who make the decisions. Well, let's turn that over, Stu Bondurant. I mean, aren't doctors really kind of helpless in the face of these many larger pressures that invite, if not force, rising costs? How about that?
Well, I would say that doctors are not entirely helpless, but doctors are by no means the only actor who are the only participant in the cost containment dialogue or in implementing cost containment considerations. I think, like Phil, that the record of the last decade is one of lack of success in our ability. And I do think that we've learned some things, however. In the early 1980s, the idea was that competition could be purposefully encouraged in the medical field in order to help to contain costs. I believe that the record shows that that was a failure, that the kind of competition, at least, that was inserted into medical practice in the 1980s has not reduced the cost.
Does that mean that the HMOs are going to be on the way out? One of the questions that I wanted to put to you in the course of this conversation is roughly as follows. Is American capitalism incompatible with the practice of medicine in the 1990s? How about this, Phil?
I don't believe that the American capitalism is incompatible with the practice of medicine. I do believe that as employers shoulder an ever-increasing portion of the healthcare dollar, they will, within the confines of the capitalist system, want a greater say in defining how care is given. The cost that employers contribute to the care of employees has doubled in the last 5 years. It's in large corporations, they are paying about $4,000 per individual employee per year in healthcare costs. You can't face that kind of a financial burden without, I think, fairly demanding a say in how healthcare is delivered. Now, the question is how to work with that fact in a way that maximizes the ability of the physician to give good care and the patient to maximize his or her ability to pick and choose among physicians to establish that trusting relationship.
Who's in charge of this picture, Sue Bondrin? You've got the government, you've got corporations, you've got individuals, you've got physicians. Is there anybody running this show, or are we all going off in different directions coming up with different answers?
Well, I think that's one of the most difficult issues. Certainly in the U.S., we have a pluralistic system of health care. Whether a monolithic system of health care where there is someone in charge and a single voice would be an improvement or not is an open and unproved question.
Call that a dictatorship, and we don't like those things.
We don't, and our society, our culture is different from the cultures of other countries of the world in some ways. It suggests that it may be inevitable that there's more diversity in our system and need for more diversity than in some of the other systems.
Let's talk about some specific issues when we put a word like diversity on the table. Stuart Bondrin, Phil Riley, the right to die issue, abortion, the institutional response of physicians to a terrible problem such as AIDS. I'll give you three of them there. You can pick and choose. Phil Riley.
Well, the abortion debate has often, it seems, dominated American political discourse in the last 18 years since the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. I don't think that it has had a tremendously traumatic effect on the practice of medicine. Much discussed, but I think that for the most part, obstetricians have just gone with the law of the land, and women who have perceived an erosion of their rights have responded politically to that. I think personally that the abortion debate has peaked, and that a woman's right to terminate her pregnancy will never be absolutely removed, largely because of technological issues, I might add. With the advent of a new drug called RU486, which is essentially a chemical abortifacient, it may be that the technology of abortion will be so changed that it will be removed from the hospital and placed in the privacy of a doctor's office and really beyond the reach of the law anyway.
Well, you still have political pressures, though. I mean, at the time that we're doing this taping session, the state of Utah, for better or worse, is in the headlines. ACLU running ads saying if a woman has an abortion in the state of Utah, what do you do with her? You shoot her. And now that, of course, is an exaggeration and dramatic for the purposes of publicity. What about this, Stuart Bondrin?
Well, it seems to me that illustrates a principle. I agree with Phil that the abortion debate is probably peaked and that technology will catch up with this. But in terms of abortion and right to die and your examples, these really are examples of where medical practice intersects with health, with public policy, not just health policy, but public policy and public value systems, the value system of our country. It seems to me that the role of medicine in this is to inform the debate, but not to determine the ultimate outcome. And with respect to right to die and with respect to abortion, both, I think that those are both broad public issues. The same is true of cost containment, I think. That the real decisions of how much we spend on health care have to be broad public decisions and not just medical decisions.
What about the AIDS issue? How do physicians talk back and forth amongst themselves? You have the moral dimension, you have the political dimension, you have the medical aspects. Does any one of those necessarily take precedence in the way physicians talk? Phil Riley?
I don't see anyone as taking precedence. When I hear talk among physicians about AIDS, frankly, I think I hear conversations not dissimilar from those in the general public. Fear that I as a physician or that a nurse, more likely, will be exposed to blood of an individual who's carrying the HIV virus. I think that there is a sensitivity to the rights of the individual at-risk patient, but that has to be weighed against a public health concern. This debate about AIDS testing is not the first time our society has entered into such a controversy. One can go back 100 years to hear debates about compulsory vaccination, for example, about what is the tension, what is the balance between the individual's right to privacy and the assertion of the public health power for a greater good. It is a tension that informs the practice of public health in the United States.
Do we learn anything from history? I mean, the historian, here we are at the Humanities Center. How about this, Phil, as you look back on the vaccination, or Stu Bondrant, either one.
Go ahead, Phil.
I personally think that in our tradition of law, constitutional law in this nation, that the public health power has been defined rather broadly, and it is clear that should the society at large be threatened by an epidemic, that the state is empowered to enter into it. Now, it's a separate question as to whether or not AIDS represents the degree of public health risk that constitutes a societal threat. I think not.
Epidemic is a word that you see in the newspapers all the time. Right. Is that journalism or is that medicine?
Epidemic, to me, implies a level of horizontal transmission from individual to individual that is really not an accurate reflection of what occurs with AIDS, which is a venereally or bloodborne transmitted disorder. The risk, the plague in 14th century Europe probably killed 20-30% of the population in a decade. Nothing like that's going to happen with AIDS in the United States.
Stuart Bondrant, again, you're a medical dean at the University of North Carolina. What is the talk like among and between the physicians and the students there about the institutional response of medicine to this problem?
Well, I think that the talk among students and physicians in Chapel Hill is comparable to that nationwide, and that is to say, as I hear it, there are many different views. There range from physicians who are very, very conservative, illustrated by some outspoken people in California, for example, who want public testing and public display of the results of the testing, to what I believe to be the more representative view of physicians, to the effect that AIDS is a disease like other diseases, and its patterns of spread are known and understood and are containable, and that we have an obligation and a responsibility to care for patients with AIDS no different materially from that of patients with any other disease.
Phil Riley?
I think Stuart just made an important, if tangential, point to his main comments, and that is that when you ask about medicine, you're asking about the views of hundreds of thousands of individuals scattered across the 50 states. And
it's not monolithic.
Not at all. And in large respect, reflects the spectrum of views in the society at large. And I think that's important. And it's also important to know that patients and society influences the views of physicians.
Uh-huh. What about our drug problems in the United States? Do physicians bear any social responsibility as we strive for a solution to addiction in this country? Stuart Bondrant?
Well, I believe that the drug problem is both a social and a medical problem, and in that sense, physicians certainly do bear a responsibility. Society at large bears a responsibility as well, and by that I don't mean just the law enforcement dimensions at all. I mean the educational dimensions, the social and economic dimensions of our society, or social and economic aspects of our society that interact with the drug, addictive circumstances that lead to addiction. So that I do feel that medical education and medical practice have not been in the forefront of addressing the problem of addiction, that in addition to the need for greater social attention to addiction nationally, there is need and opportunity for medical education and medical practice to be more effective. One striking example of this is that until within the last few months, there was no capacity in the state of North Carolina, for example, or in most other states, to care for a pregnant addict. And one of the consequences of the lack of a facility to care for pregnant addicts is that the pregnancies were predictably bad pregnancies, and society is burdened with the cost of babies that need very expensive care. We've just recently put in a facility for this purpose in North Carolina to care for addicted pregnant women, but it's not adequate.
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You're listening to the second segment in a series of conversations about medicine and social ethics. The speakers are two physicians, Philip Riley of the Shriver Center in Waltham, Massachusetts, and Stuart Bondurant, Dean of the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
One of the things that we look at demographically is pluralism in the United States. Minorities rising, as it were, in the professions. Is that going to be a force in medicine and medical education as you see it down the pike here, Stuart Bondurant?
I would say, in a sense, belatedly. I believe that medicine has not been as effective as it should have been in including minorities in the practice of medicine. We are suffering, to some extent, I think, now, in some of the maldistribution of physicians across the nation, geographically and by specialty, as a result of the mismatch between the mix of physicians in relation to the mix of people in the population.
Phil Riley?
Not only will we benefit by having an increasing percentage of the profession from the various minority groups that are represented in our society with an ever-increasing frequency, such as, for example, Hispanics, but it's important to point out that each of these students will bring a cultural sensitivity to his patient population from which he sprang, if you will, that might be lacking in a white physician. I've had any number of experiences in my life where, for example, a diagnosis in a Vietnamese immigrant was missed because of my inability to understand the culture and the manner in which he perceived and explained his illness. On a more scientific basis, it was a black physician who recently reported, I believe, that the race of the blood donor to an individual receiving blood may in fact matter, may reduce the number of transfusion reactions, a kind of racial component to medicine that we might traditionally have been afraid to mention because of the thought that it was overlaid with prejudice. But I think that diversity within the profession will make for better medicine. We'll learn from it.
Mm-hmm. Apropos of your conversation here, Stuart Bondurant, Phil Riley, about addiction in the United States, that's an emergency. What about emergency medicine? Phil Riley, you had some comments on that.
Yes, I think particularly, although not exclusively, in the inner cities, the large urban hospitals, there is a incredible pressure right now on a beleaguered staff of emergency room nurses and physicians. The level of violence is at an all-time high. Much of that, as we know, is drug-related. The number of patients who come in suddenly with no history, yet in acute medical or surgical crisis, is astounding. The ability of the physicians in the smaller urban hospitals to give them the kind of care they need is challenged. All sorts of problems arise. One, just the cost of caring for these individuals, many of whom have no medical insurance whatsoever, so there's no reimbursement to the hospital and the physician. The critical decisions that have to be made in moments about whether to keep them in a given facility or send them elsewhere, decisions that are now complicated by federal legislation that can punish and fine hospitals for sending patients elsewhere if they are perceived to be doing so for economic reasons.
Well, there aren't answers to problems like this in textbooks. I mean, where I'll look at you wide-eyed. Where do the answers to problems like this come from? Stuart Bondurant?
Well, the answer has to come in part, I think, from financing. The first thing is that there's not enough money in the system to pay for the care of the patients, especially in the center city areas. But the same is true in rural hospitals. Many of the people who appear in emergency rooms due to trauma or drugs or many of the other things are uninsured. So to some extent, this is a reflection of the fact that there are between 35 and 40 million Americans who have no health insurance, and when the emergency rooms aren't paid for the services that they render.
That costs the society. The taxpayers eventually end up coughing it up.
Costs society. Beyond that, we've not trained emergency medical care providers as extensively as we should. The specialty of emergency medicine is a decade old in this country at this time, and Many major academic medical centers do not have residency programs, for example, in emergency medicine. Many are just beginning now to put in training programs for physicians.
I can't imagine that they would want to. I mean, looking at the track record, that they would want to incur that sort of an obligation, financial and moral.
Well, many of them can't afford to, because if they do incur that financial obligation, they will underserve some other component of their social obligation. And, and that's the reason my first point was that there needs to be more money in the system for the care of this kind of a patient, I think, before the problem would be resolved.
Phil?
And what we really need is a strategy to take the individual who comes in crisis to the emergency room, physician and nurse, and make sure that that individual leaves with a primary care physician in place. That is not an easy task.
A part of a coherent system of care. That's correct.
Stuart Bondurant, Phil Riley, what about our elderly population? How do doctors talk back and forth about this? Is it a problem, a challenge? What, Phil?
It's certainly a challenge, and I've been very pleased to see the rise of geriatric medicine over the last two decades. The fastest growing population group in America is the 85 and older set. Population that has been fortunate to live a long life is inevitably burdened with many chronic disorders, loss of their own family structure, a concomitant depression. It's a real challenge to medicine, and when I say medicine, I include the very important role of nursing to compassionately care for these people, to provide the kinds of supports that are not naturally available, and to work in systems such as the nursing home environment, which does not necessarily lend itself to the best kind of doctor-patient interaction.
Well, one of the issues that's implicit here, if I hear you right, Phil Riley, is what we talked about before, and that's cost containment, and that is, again, catastrophic care. That I remember Chase Peterson, who's a physician at the University of Utah, the president of the University of Utah, talking about how we spend enormous amounts of money on the last moment of an individual's life. Stuart Bondurant, talk to me about this.
Well, the observation is certainly a valid one. We do spend large fractions of our total federal health care dollar and other dollars in the last moment of life. It does, though, in another sense, I think, represent one of the very serious conundrums of this issue of cost containment. A study was done by Dr. Marion Danis in the critical care units at the University of North Carolina hospitals a year or so ago, in which Dr. Danis asked a group of patients who had spent a month in a critical care unit and survived, and she asked the families of the non-survivors how much additional life of the same quality that they were then experiencing they would have to have in order to put up with another month in the intensive care unit. The paper was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association about 6 months ago, I guess. And the response for most of the patients was that for one more week of life, they would spend another month under the same conditions, intubated and sedated in an intensive care unit. The point is just that set forth what one would do in the abstract. It's very much of a different matter when one is faced with the termination of one's own life at a particular point. And most people opt for taking greater steps to prolong life when they are faced with the reality of the situation than do when asked the question in the abstract.
Stuart Bondurant, Phil Riley, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation about medicine and social ethics. The Hippocratic Oath in the 1990s. Here is an ancient document, one that is honored. Is it still alive and well in the medical community, notwithstanding all the bells and the whistles and the progress that we have made? Stuart?
Well, I have for 17 years now administered the Hippocratic Oath at commencement to a group of students graduating from one or another of two medical schools, knowing all of that time that in many respects this is an obsolete instrument designed centuries ago, millennia ago. It is intended, it can't be taken literally. It doesn't begin to touch the role of a physician in relation to a patient in the modern world. I believe it's a metaphor, a metaphorical expression of a sense of social commitment on the part of the physician and an acceptance of a responsibility that is different from that of other citizens in relation to patients and in relation to society and in relation to the profession. If I were writing it myself now, I would make it far more specific and far more explicit. On the other hand, there's some virtues to recognizing the antiquity of these principles and the generality across cultures and across millennia in time. And for that reason, I remain comfortable in using this metaphor at commencement.
Phil Riley?
I would point out that two of the most important principles of medical ethics that I believe guide physicians today are still valid. That is, first, do no harm. Make sure that if you're going to intervene in a patient's life, it's in a positive way. And second, the principle of confidentiality. Even in a world riddled with reporting duties, I think physicians must and do take very seriously the need to respect the privacy of the interaction with the patient.
Stuart Bondrin, final thoughts.
Can I just add two others to Phil's to those two of Phil's? I believe that, that fundamentally, and this is stated in the Hippocratic Oath in some other words, that the physician's responsibility is to put the interests of the patient before his own interest, his or her own interest, under all professional circumstances. And the physician assumes that responsibility. Patients should be able to count on that responsibility. And the second thing, second ethical obligation, is to give every patient the very best of which that physician is capable. I would add those two.
Stuart Bondurant is Dean of the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Philip Riley directs the Shriver Center in Waltham, Massachusetts. The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to the second segment in a series of conversations about medicine and social ethics. For a cassette copy of the preceding conversation, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 561. That's program number 561. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Send $2 for a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Thanks for listening to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Next week, join me for conversations about the philosophy of Aristotle. My guests will be Michael Woods of the University of Oxford and Richard Jenko of the University of California at Los Angeles.
You've been listening to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program came from the Burroughs Wellcome Company, a research-based pharmaceutical company with corporate headquarters and laboratories in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Additional support for this edition of Soundings came from the Eugene Garfield Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Medicine and Social Ethics, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with two prominent physicians, Stuart Bondurant, Dean of the Medical School at the University of North Carolina, and Philip Riley, Director of the Shriver Center. We'll talk about cost containment, AIDS and abortion, and the ethics of physicians with their patients. Medicine and Social Ethics, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.